I like this crowd. Yeah. All right. So I'm very happy to be here. I'm even happier that you've been drinking. And I hope that the dim lights will help you fall asleep. But so today I want to tell you what is probably more relevant to this course is to talk about a new methodology that we've realized in the lab, and other labs have also contributed tremendously to it, notably Mike Marco, before I forget, I'll say it right now, in Albany. And we are extremely excited about it, and I hope you will too. Which is using a microscope, new kind of microscope that FEI must love us because now they can sell you a new microscope. It's called a focus ion beam. So we do focus ion beam milling of cells in order to put them in the TEM. And in the process, I'll talk to you about the driving project or the main driving project in the lab. Now we have a few others for this technology, which is determining the structure to the of the nuclear pore complex, which is sort of like my new love. So I'll tell you a little bit about the nuclear pore complex. You know, the nucleus is the defining element of a eukaryotic cell, and it's the greatest organelle in the universe. It has two concentric membranes that surround it. It's called the nuclear envelope. And everything that comes in and out of the nucleus, so when cells decided to compartmentalize genetic information, they also needed to talk to the rest of the cell. And this is done through these massive complexes that are called nuclear pore complex that perforate two membranes, not one, two membranes. They're very difficult to study. And basically everything, they're like molecular bouncers. Everything that has to come in and out of the cell goes through there. And they're actually pretty cool biophysical machines. They're super highly selective, even though they're huge and they have multiple transport events at the same time. We won't talk about the cool stuff here because it's very difficult to determine structurally. But basically, if you're a very small protein or an ion or anything less than 40 kilodaltons, you can freely diffuse through the pores. But if you're anything bigger, you have to have a nuclear import signal or nuclear export signal. And then this is done through a RAN GTP gradient. And I'm sure a lot of you know about it. But what's important for this crowd is that it's a very large macromolecular machine. It's not the largest macromolecular complex, presumably machine. I don't know, people contend. But it's a very large macromolecular machine. It varies a lot in size across different species, so it can be like really from higher eukaryotes to smaller ones, half of the size, presumably. And again, spans two membranes, so hard to purify. Little bits and pieces fall off all the time. And it's composed of actually about 400 proteins, but there's only 30 different kinds of proteins, and these are called NUPs. And the cool thing about it is that these proteins are arranged in subcomplexes. So, for example, in organisms that have open mitosis, where the nuclear envelope completely dissolves for cell division, some of these subcomplexes remain as subcomplexes for the entire life of the cell. This is why, one of the reasons why this is sort of the poster child for integrative modeling, again, coming back to Andrew Shelley, and he won't talk about the nuclear pore on Friday, but it's something that's also close to his heart. So this is to scale so that you get an idea of what the size of this complex is. So I come from the land of 2 million particles, or one of the lands of 2 million particles, but please don't expect, check your gold standards at the door. This is, this is sort of potatoes, okay? So forget about, high level of resolution and so forth. It's a very large complex. So this is a complex that's ideally suited for tomography because, as I described before, it's very difficult to purify. And you purify, tons of bits and pieces fall, and as you see, it's actually flexible and liable and all sorts of things. This is a structure that was obtained in a lab a few years ago from isolated nuclei from dictyostelium. So the nucleus have both membranes, and this is what you can get. And again, this is a ribosome to scale. So in this case, tomography is a great tool for getting a scaffold of the entire structure. But when I came to the lab, there were a number of reasons why I decided to work on the nuclear pore complex, and one of them was, again, sort of this appeal of using data from many different sources to put it together into one model, as had been done before, except in the past few years, a lot of people have been working in structural, biochemical, and all sorts of omics data that go into the MPC. And just like we discussed today about the proteasome, or initially other proteins as well, this is a problem where a very high-resolution structure can serve as a wonderful scaffold onto which to put everything else. You can't have stoichiometry problems if you have, like, the right molecular weight of double of it, or it can hint of where things can go. And so attempts had been before, of course, to push the resolution. So what was different in this case? First of all, I wanted to do in Servicio because all of the data that's available is in Servicio. It's a small port and there's no structure of it at all, or there was one in 1993, but it was not very good at the time. But the key idea was to try to use thinner samples, and you'll see that this was not only good for the sake of having thinner samples, but also to have better samples and so forth. Okay, so now we're going to live in this realm, not these guys. So subtomogram averaging would be the choice. And most of you know about it. For those of you who don't, basically you can take a tomogram where instead of taking hundreds of thousands of pictures of different molecules that look the same, you take many pictures of the same molecule or cell or whatsoever. But you can then go and pick out molecules that look similar and then do the same algorithms, but in 3D, that are used for classification. And the reason I mentioned this is I want you to try go and visit Yushan's poster. He's a student of Friedrich Foerster, who's in our department, and he has a very nice method called PyTom for subtomogram averaging. So if you're thinking of choosing methods, I hope you saw Danny's talk. I'm sure it was great. I wasn't here, but it's very good software, but this one is also good. So give it a visit. All right, so now the problem with tomography, or the feature, whatever you want to call it, is that sample thickness is the worst thing, right? So this is a mammalian cell, and you can see, I mean, you can really only access the periphery and everything else. So of course, the nucleus is out of the question in most things. So what happens today is that people, when you want to do it in intact cells, you spend a lot of time looking for a cell where you can access something, or, you know, some exotic cell that has a mitochondria at the periphery or so forth, or otherwise you're stuck. Not to say that there's other alternatives, and I'll talk about it in a minute. But I just want to point out that even in this realm, you can do some really cool stuff. This is one of my favorite projects in the lab right now. This is the project of a postdoc that's Marion Jasnin, who's also my office mate and friend, and I work very closely with her. And she is looking at the architecture of Listeria monocytogenes, who infects cells, takes over the actin machinery. And I just want to say, tomography by itself can be very cool and quantitative, and sometimes you can do it in intact cells. So this is a tale of Listeria. This is this particular bacteria that's protruding out of a cell, and we can take a tomogram of this cell. And using template matching, which is basically more or less the same as super resolution, you can use a template that has the right missing wedge, and you can go out and try to detangle all the actin bacteria. By the way, go and tell your friends this is much cooler than Storm, where they can only do two sheets of actin. And then you can go back and quantify all of this. So this is some analysis that I did for Marion, where you can go in each filament, look at the nearest neighbor and all the local vicinity, and find that, in fact, it's either packed in sheets or in hexagonal lattices. So this is actually actin bundles that are doing probably the fourth generation as opposed to individual actin filaments. And you can take a look at neighbors. And these patterns actually change at different stages of infection. So just a parenthesis is kind of cool. But the alternatives, what we really do most of the time to the tomography is one of the things, and you actually hear Werner talking about it in beautiful work on Friday, is isolating organelles and then looking at them, isolating organelles, and then sort of you can do a lot of cool biochemistry with them and so forth, putting them on the grid and look at them that way. And this is what I did here at the beginning of the project where we were getting the focus ion beam to work. And of course, you always have to have a backup plan. And so this is my backup plan, picking up a pipette, which for a physicist is not a very good backup plan. But nevertheless, here are isolated yeast nuclei. First thing that comes to mind, of course, if you take a haploid cell, the nuclei are already very small, so half of the size of what we had before. So I was happy. Okay, maybe they're thin enough. Maybe I'm done. And this is what they look under grid. So just to point you out, this is, again, the nuclear envelope that I was telling you about. And these perforations to the nuclear envelopes are nuclear pores. So this is a side view of a nuclear pore. And as the tomogram plays out, you'll see top views or grazing views of the nuclear pores. I wanted to point out, I was very proud of the fact that that there's ribosomes bound. Yeast doesn't have a lot of ER, so the outer nuclear membrane serves effectively as most of the ER surface. And I figured, ooh, I was so gentle, I have all the ribosomes. This actually turned out to be a nightmare because they were very difficult to align. So you always end up with a polyribosome, two or three ribosomes, never a nuclear pore because they just had all the signals, so I had to blow them up. But this wasn't the real problem. So anyway, gentle purification and whatnot. And so this is what we had at the time. So here you see these grazing views, tons of ribosomes over here. So it's sort of going back and forth. To cut this story short, I'll tell you that this didn't work out so well. The resolution was stuck at about the same resolution that was obtained before for isolated nuclei and nuclear pores. And it didn't really matter how many particles I did and how many tricks I tried to do. That's as far as we got, which is, this is one of these reconstructions. The other alternative that people use for thickness of cells is cryo-ultramicrotomy. And I keep getting told that about 5 or 7 people in the world can do this properly and everybody else is just fooling themselves. I don't even try. I mean, I haven't even gone into that room. I'm very scared. But this is what cryosections look like. So even the people who do it well end up with things that look like this in an SEM. So as you can tell, they're not as flat and beautiful as one would hope. And they're very useful for a number of things, but they become very, it's a very hard argument to make when you want to quantify data that comes from these, or if you want to do subtomogram averaging of things that have over 30% compression in one direction. So here's an example. This is, again, isolating. It's not an organelle, but rather this is, I think, from a mouse brain. You smoosh it with some homogenizer and throw it on the grid, and miraculously to me anyway, some of the synapses, or at least the synaptic clefts, are preserved, and then you can do tomography. Here you see vesicles, as biophysics would dictate, are round and pretty and close to the membrane. And this is from tissue, from a hippocampal cryosection. Here you can see the vesicles are pretty squished around. And this, of course, depends on what you want to learn, is a problem. It's certainly a problem for subtomogram averaging. But, I mean, it's a great technique, and you know, it's the standard of the field. But there was sort of the need or excitement about moving into different things. So this is, as in many other labs, what we try to establish in the lab, which is workflow for electron tomography. We just start with the normal vitrification, and then you can maybe do some... you can have some tags, here's a yeast cell dividing, to find certain regions that are interesting for you. So this can be looked just for finding regions in the grid or as functional assays. And then you can go and thin your samples, because even if you localize the cool kids in here, you can't go and look at them. But you can thin your samples, and I'll talk about this today, and then you can go and do tomography. So today I will tell you mostly about this part. So this is our shiny focus ion beam. It's a dual beam from FEI. What a dual beam means is that it has a normal SEM, and it has another beam, which is, in this case, from gallium ions. And you can use this microscope to simply image things. You put a crap load of those on them. Or you can use them for milling. And this is a microscope that is used routinely in material sciences. Actually, Radov Danev, who's in our lab now, makes his faceplates in this very guy, and there's all sorts of nanotubes and nanopores and things, or nanopores, not nanotubes, that get made in these guys every day. So if you actually go back to your university and you look up in some websites, there will be a focus ion beam somewhere, I guarantee you. They're very ubiquitous, but you know, not necessarily people want to share them, but they're around. So so this is, of course, a room temperature microscope, and there's 3 companies right now, if I'm not mistaken, and another one has popped up, that sell a cryo stage for them. So there's this bit here that you add up, and they basically, you have a transfer station to put in cryo samples, and you have to keep this whole guy at cryo conditions. And we have made some adjustments to the stage, and the shuttle and everything that came from Quorum, and it's a great system, and I highly recommend it. I don't have any experience with other ones, but both FEI and Quorum have all of our designs, so you can ask for them directly from them, but you can also feel free to ask us. We have a pretty good workshop and engineers. So the first idea was, okay, so I already have the isolated nuclei, and my suspicion was that it was simply that maybe the samples are not thin enough. So why don't we just thin first the nuclei and check it out? So the idea is, with a focus ion beam, if you come at a very shallow angle, you literally just kick out layers of atoms at a time. And if you do it at a shallow angle, you have very, very small gallium deposition on your sample. So then that means that you can cut a nucleus in half, oh joy, you'll still have nuclear pores pointing in all orientations, so no missing wedge when you average out, and that's perfect. So this was the first attempt, and don't try this at home. It was just extremely difficult, and it didn't work at all. The idea was take a grid that already has nuclei on it, and I really wanted to go parallel, right? Not on an angle, completely parallel, and take half of a nucleus away. So this is a grid that you would have under liquid nitrogen, take a knife and cut it. You know, you don't even know where the grid bars are. And if you're lucky, like in this place, you actually cut it like right under the grid bar, so you have all of these nuclei exposed. So you can then rotate around the microscope. This is a view from the SEM. Rotate around the microscope to expose just a few nuclei over there. And then if you can imagine the focus ion beam coming from the top, like from the ceiling down in the plane of the screen now, then you have a view of this sort of nuclei that are exposed to the ion beam. So this is the view from the focus ion beam, and you can see here the nucleus just sticking out. And then this is actually real time. This is what a milling looks like. Kind of looks like a Second World War movie. But that's really sort of nuking away the focus ion beam. Here I got greedy and I also did the bottom because it was just fun. So there you're left with a thin lamella, so if you want to say it's like a third of a nucleus or whatever, that's now very thin, and you can go to the TEM and it should be fantastic. And this is the first, okay, so this is what it looks like. Here's the same view. Actually, this is a little bit tilted with respect to this one, but here are the nuclei before, sort of all over, and here you see that they've been milled away, and you can still see a change in density between where the hole is and where the nucleus was, so there's still some mass in there. And so the idea was, okay, at least you get the periphery of the nuclear envelope and probably catch a few pores. And so the first source of drama, and actually Bridget told me specifically to tell about the problems we had to overcome, and trust me, it's going to be a whiny talk. The first source of drama was the transfer. Here we lost at the beginning about 95% of our samples. So you have this very fragile exposed carbon surface, and then you take it out of the FIB and put it back in liquid nitrogen and run to the Polarac, clip it. It was not pretty. And so most of the lamellas were broken. It was really bad. We have an extremely good workshop and an incredible engineer, Tim Lux. And so the first idea was, you know, we're so happy with autogrids for the Titan. Can we use the autogrids? Because they're amazing stability, so you clip it before you mill, and then you mill it, and then you're good to go. And the problem, of course, is I said we wanted to go to very shallow angles. So at this point, I was convinced that the half grid was not probably the best way to go. But still, you want to come as the shallowest angles as possible, and you want this to be defined by your grid bar, not by this huge autogrid, and then you have to go at a super high angle. So we modified autogrids in our workshop to have a peephole on the side. These go in a shuttle that I'm not showing here that we designed to hold two autogrids. It used to hold two grids. And so we don't have to clip them back into the Polara. We can simply just put the autogrid. We modify the Polara. You just have to mill away and get like a little clamp over here so you can put the autogrid directly in the Polara. And of course, I had, in horror, people from FEI come and tell me, please tell me you're not putting this in the Titan. And we're like, no. Yet. And so we actually ended up going to Eindhoven with, it was actually pretty cool, with just like all the Titan team and the FIB team. And then they designed a grid that looks a lot like this one, except that I don't have a picture actually with me, I'm sorry. But it's, there's a little, the peephole then has, so this surface is actually covered so the chopsticks don't have a problem. So now we can put autogrids in the Titan with no problem, no fear, no pew, autoloader. Just throwing grids around. So this works okay. And this was a godsend. Like after this, you basically don't lose any lamella. So maybe one every 20 or something like that, but it's really not important anymore. So it was fantastic. So that's the first whining event. So once with the autogrids and this sort of half nuclei and whatever, I'm just going to show you as a proof of principle, although it's going to get much better, I promise. This is half a nucleus. So you're going to see earlier you saw like the top and the grazing views and then the nuclear envelope from the side and then the bottom. And here you see, this was very exciting at the time, by the way. It's like nothing and then, boom, the nuclear envelope right there. So it's half of the nucleus is gone. And of course, it turns out that it didn't make much of a difference because the thickness was a little bit better. But as a matter of fact, it was more or less comparable.
So still nothing too exciting. You definitely needed less dose to get, and you could use smaller defocus and so forth. But it was really not going to make it. And the reason why, now it's clear, but it was already suspicious at the time, is of course that the nucleus are super squashed during blotting. And it doesn't matter how gentle you do it, because if they're not squashed, you're not going to be able to image them at all anyway. And that's how it looks like. So if you think of the radius of curvature of a nucleus, it should be about the half of the size. And this would be the curvature that you should have in this membrane. So let me go back so you see. But as a matter of fact, I mean, it's, of course, difficult to estimate, but it seems like this guy has been compressed to like 30% its size. So of course, it's squished around. Okay, so it's not perfect. Well, yeah, it was good for a while, but it's not perfect. All right, so the next thing was, anyway, why work with isolated nuclei if the goal since the beginning was to use cells? And this is, I mean, literally opening windows into the cell. So now you can see all sorts of things. So that was the plan. Take a cell, just mill it at the middle, and then get all the goodies out of it. So this is what cells look like. These are mammalian cells when they're grown on an EM grid. This is a view from the focus ion beam. And then again, the idea is that you have your SEM beam that we use to just check how we're doing. And I'll explain this in a minute. It'll be clear. And then the focus ion beam, that's about a 45-degree angle from the SEM. And so this is how you do the milling. So you orient it so you can do the milling with a focus ion beam. And then you have a top view from the SEM. And again, this is how a cell looks like from the focus ion beam. So the focus ion beam will be looking at the cell right now up front. So you can tell that the grid is at an angle. That's carbon overblotted completely, but actually doesn't seem to matter, I suppose, the inside of the cell. And then the top view, sort of, again, a view from the ceiling will be what you see from the SEM. And the software for material sciences for the focus ion beam is incredibly good. I mean, you can actually mill Mickey Mouse if you want. So you can put patterns, a lot sort of bitmaps, and trust me, Felix is a very talented grad student in the lab who's done a lot of work with the FIB, spends 2 days making his acknowledgement slides for our lab retreat. But they're very pretty. And so, but the point is that the software is very easy to use, which is, of course, a welcome thing for electron microscopes. And what you do is you define patterns on the cell, sort of like that, and you mill them away. And we actually do it in an iterative form. So if your cell is very large, you start with a relatively high current, you just nuke away a lot of things, and then you go with gentler currents to do a very thin thing. So this is the view from above, and I'm going to show you a movie in a minute to make it clearer. But so that we're clear, before this would have just been like a ball with carbon everywhere. And so what we have right now is a freestanding lamella that supports itself on what's left of the cell on both sides. So let me see if this makes it clearer. This was made by Tim, our engineer, who also does amazing movies. So here's what the milling would do. And so you end up with a freestanding lamella, which is about 300 nanometers in thickness. So that's what we aim for, something about 300 nanometers. And it's a sweet spot between having something that's thin enough, but yet it will contain, you know, enough interesting things. So the size of a nuclear pore complex is about 100 nanometers. You want to have mostly, you know, a few full pores, not too many half pores, but it really depends on what you're looking at. All right, so this is, again, sort of now that you saw the movie, you understand this is the top of the cell. And luckily, because we have autogrids, you know, you can take the cell and go to the transmission electron microscope and find exactly the same area. They're very easy to find. You have a few per grid. We normally would do sort of like in a, it takes about an hour. I'm going to make a parenthesis and tell you. It takes about an hour to get your grid in the microscope and get ready to work, like from cooling it down to mounting the grid and everything when you're a little bit more experienced before. It's really scary. But, you know, now it's routine, and, you know, like with every microscope. And then it takes about 45 minutes to an hour to make each lamella with all the cleaning steps and whatever. It, of course, depends on the size of the cell, but I would say something like 45 minutes is about right. You end up making like 6 or so per day. You have 2 grids in the shuttle at any given time. You can make 2 if you're, you know, work inclined, and then another person can take over, so you can really have in a day a lot. And the size of a lamella, typically, but again, it depends on the cells that you're using, can be about 10 to 12 microns in width. And the length, of course, will depend at what angle you come. So it's a very shallow angle. It will be defined by the size of your cell, or a little bit shorter. And so this is what a lamella looks like. So this is about 10 by 10 microns in this particular case. And you see these streaks over here. We call them curtaining. And I'll tell you a little bit about them later in another winding session. So this is the membrane of the cell. So this is, and here you see the nucleus, and there's some pretty mitochondria and all sorts of other vesicles. And I don't know if you're impressed, but the signal is amazing. And that's just a projection. That's a tomogram. And so there's a tomogram right there. You see there again... mitochondria and ribosomes that are everywhere, and the nuclear envelope, and you see the nuclear pores. And this is, look at the MPCs over there. Again, this is a curtain over here. And yeah, I don't know.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes, of course.
So this is my lack of knowledge, but does the nucleus span the height of the cell, or is that why you choose?
No, but that's an excellent question, and I'll talk about it a little bit later. No, so targeting where to mill is very important. So for me, I don't care because the nucleus will take it's about 10% of the cell volume, but if you come at that distance, most of the time you'll hit a nucleus. So yee, lucky me. But if you're looking at for a centrosome or something like that, I'll talk about it, then, you're in a world of grief, but, Okay, so... I want to tell you again about this movie, especially this movie was made by Alex Rigord, and he here filled the missing wedge of the microtubules for your viewing pleasure. There's ER over there. This is, again, the nuclear envelope, and you see these perforations are MPCs, ribosomes, some big things. Sorry to tell Bob I can't see the little things yet, but okay, but it's still pretty good data. And when I show this, often people tell me that then they just sort of go away and think of their own cell and the things that they could be looking at. And in fact, this is cool because, the limit basically is vitrification, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. So I told you I like looking at yeast. Yeast cells are kind of tiny, and making a teeny lamella in a little yeast cell would be too teeny of a lamella because then you have to tilt and you will get shadowing. So you have to work out every time you start with a new cell. There will be conditions, not as exotic as Holger defined, but still you have to play around with cell density and these things. So for yeast, I just have enough cells that I make little sort of yeast pools, and then you mill away, and then, of course, lucky me, I'll just, cut through a bunch of nuclei, and I don't have to worry about much more. And, of course... you're now seeing nuclear transport in situ, right? These pores are actually transporting things, which are very difficult things to do with isolated nuclei, especially in certain species. There's no compression that we can see from the knife, from the milling. And, most importantly, of course, there's no fixing. But so this is more or less what a yeast puddle would look like. And something that I'll talk about later, which is interesting, is if you actually have, even though yeast cells are thin, if you have too many cells on the grid, the vitrification will not go well. So this is something to think about when you are really sort of putting full cells. But this is what a lamella looks like. And I don't know if you need to squint or you can more or less see the cells over there, but if you can't, it's okay, because now this is the region in the transmission electron microscope. So this is exactly the same lamella after a successful transfer. So you see there's a bunch of yeast cells over here, and this thick region over here is a platinum coat that also solved a lot of our problems, and I'll tell you a little bit about it later. But here I want to focus, if you just pick one cell, this cell, as you can tell here, it was dividing. And again, you can see a nice mitochondria here. I happen to catch a spindle pole body. You will be able to see it in a while. So there's a nucleus. This is just crap. And but the cell wall, you can see endocytosis and exocytosis events. So you see over here ER and all sorts of things. So it's a pretty, I don't know if you notice the difference between now and before, but this is a pretty smooth lamella, so there's no kerning anymore. I'll tell you more about that. All right, so that's a tomogram, and I'm sorry, I always seem to not get the contrast right in tomograms. Now it's sort of too black and white, but sometimes they look too gray. But this is this region over here, so you see again the nuclear envelope over there, perforations that are nuclear pores. Here you can see the spindle pole body. I don't know if you can see, there's a few microtubules coming in and out, and you see some perpendicular ones over here, and of course ribosomes that are everywhere. So the next thing, of course, is now to pick out the subtomograms and start having fun with them. And because I'm very lazy, I don't like doing things by hand, I just wrote some stuff to basically pick them out for themselves. You can do subtomogram averaging in one of two ways. Don't give the subtomograms any orientation and have something like Yushen's algorithms figure it out. I'm a control freak, so I like to know what the cytoplasmic site is because there was supposed to C2 symmetry in these guys. But what you can do is automatically fit an ellipsoid to the surface of the nucleus, and that if you evaluate the normal to that surface, so in where the nuclear pores are, then you will get an approximate orientation, and then you can do subtomogram averaging on these guys. So what I'm going to show you today is actually, sadly, published proof of principle of how this thing works. So this is a subtomogram averaging from one tomogram alone. And the resolution that I reached, which is this individual tomogram, was similar to the first MPC that we got in the lab before I came for Dictyostelium, which had about 50 times more data. And I don't think I'm that much smarter, smarter at all. So that means that the data is really just fantastic. I mean, the contrast, the alignment, it's just good. All right, this is something where Pavel here? Is he drunk? Are you drunk? All right, this is going to give me crap, but it's okay. When I started trying to align the pores together, this was also true for the isolated nuclei, you start seeing that all of a sudden it seems to break symmetry, so it's aligning certain part of the MPC better than others. What that means, of course, is that the pores are heterogeneous. They're either not all the same size or something like that. If you run autocorrelation, a rotational autocorrelation every pore, which means you just go around in the pore and see how much they look like themselves, you see, and this is true for Dictyostelium and for yeast, every single pore I ever looked at has, or at least kind of looks like, it has eightfold symmetry. I know that there's been reports that sometimes there's 9 or 10 or 7, not in my hands, but you know, it could be organism dependent. But what that means is, instead of imposing symmetry, because God knows what's happening to these guys, you can separate them in 8 little pieces. So instead of one particle, now you have 8, and then you can align them. So again, this is published. I won't show you the latest yeast structure because it's work in progress, and it sort of gets better by the day. But again, this is from one single tomogram, and the resolution is the same as we had for the first paper that had 250 pores or something like that. I will tell you some things about the yeast MPC because it's kind of exciting. So this is where we are right now. As you can see, not very high throughput. But it works, so we acquire data continuously. One thing that's interesting is that the cytoplasmic and the nucleoplasmic rings are connected to the spoke ring, which is the middle ring. I recently talked to someone who's very savvy about nuclear pore complexes in yeast, and it seems like this could actually be FG NUPS that are collapsed, and we can only see them because these pores are actually exporting and importing actively, which is kind of cool. What if you just have them isolated, they will just be goofing around. Another thing that I think is interesting is not only the pore is smaller in radius and in mass, the nuclear envelope of yeast is actually much tighter than in mammalian cells. So that means that the pore is actually shorter also in the direction of import. And finally, there's asymmetric curvature and mass distribution in the membrane. So the C2 symmetry that we have always thought about in the nuclear pore complex might not just be the case. But, and of course, a more fun category. I know I'm not in the fun category yet. So this is what now the sample looks like. This is a lamella. You can see they're a little bit pre-tilted, of course, because you came at an angle in the microscope and you see it in the reconstruction. But now, again, if we do the same exercise as before, that's the curvature of the nucleus. And this would be the curvature. This is the same curvature as here. And well enough, it's right there. So these are actually not squashed nuclei. They seem to be A-OK. But much more interestingly, when you look at individual nuclear pores now, and this is focus ion beam milled cell, so this is just rotating around for you to see it from the front, I mean, it's perfectly pretty and round. And what you're seeing here is, so this is a side view, what you're seeing here is basically this green line where it cuts sort of through the middle of the pore, and these things, these that you see outside are grazing views of the membrane on the side. Now, if I show you one, oh, so this is going sort of up and down, so now it's on the blue, and now it's going to come to the red, and back. All right, so it's very round. This is true for every single pore in every species. I've seen a couple of mammalian cells. So it's basically every time someone puts a cell on the FIB, I go and look at their pores. But also, sort of because of my interest, yeast, dicti, and some mammalian cells, and they're always pretty nice and round. And this is what they look like from the isolated nuclei. And I'm not, this is not even like the worst case scenario. So you see, we would like to think that when the nuclei were compressed, maybe the pores were just sort of shifting around or something, but they were round. And there was, of course, some proposals that this was a degree of freedom of the pores, or maybe they did this elliptical thing. And then, of course, someone ran nuclear pore, PCA, or principal component analysis, or normal modes, on a donut, and they got this degree of freedom. And said, yes, of course, this is what nuclear pores do. But it's just not true. They're always round. So this is calculating based on these alignments that I showed, but you can also do it directly on the data, the eccentricity, which is a measure of how elliptical these pores are. And I don't know why this 5 is all the way here. But anyway, they are basically a circle. They're deviating away a little bit from a circle. And this is what the pore that I just showed you is. So clearly, in the cell, nuclear pores are pretty much circular. But what's very interesting is that they're actually changing in size up to 10%. So they're actually like a shutter of a camera, if you will, where they grow in size really in a circular way. And you can calculate this for the pores based on when they align. And not only do they grow in size, and the growth in size is related to how much mass, just based by the density in the central pore, is. So the more cargo, maybe they actually can swell to get it. And so this analysis tells you a little bit about the structural dynamics of the MPC, even though it's, of course, not finished. But it sort of reminds you a little bit of work that people are doing on super resolution, except that you here actually have the structural information on top. All right, so that's what I wanted to tell you about the MPC today. Here are just a couple of teasers, because I put it on my abstract, of other cells. This is a dog kidney cell. I think that people like Dave Agard will be excited to see this heterochromatin in here. I think it's pretty cool. It doesn't mean that you can just go and do it, but no, I mean, you can go and do it. I mean, it's not going to be easy. I don't think it's, it's not that easy anyway, but at least it looks cooler, because in yeast you can't see it because it's very sparse. But anyway, it's kind of cool, and you see all sorts of cool things in the nuclear envelope, which is at the nuclear envelope periphery, which is, I think, a pretty cool place to be. You can't, even if you squint, maybe you can see there's actually acting filaments here that are probably tethered to link complexes to the inside of the cell. You could see lamins. You see here a very long microtubule and so forth. Of course, ribosomes and ER and all those things. This on the right is a mitochondria from yeast. You see here a multivesicle body going into the vacuole over here. And what's really cool, and it's something that actually Werner brought up today, is that it doesn't look much darker than the outside. And we actually, sort of one student that is passionate about ribosomes got some fungal mitochondria from Walter Neupert, and he put it in the microscope, and they really did look much darker inside. Somehow it doesn't. It looks very good. You can pick up the ribosomes very well, and this is sort of a toy project that I like to look at. I don't know, most of you probably know this, but I didn't. Mitochondrial ribosomes only make like a handful of proteins, and a lot of the other proteins have to be made by cytoplasm ribosomes, cytosolic ribosomes. So the question is whether the membranes somehow get thinner in that area when they have to come together in the inside and outside to pull complexes, and how well they co-localize. So this is the kind of data that you would be able to get out of this kind of images. All right, so with that, I'm going full whining. So what can go wrong? And it's just pretty much everything. And the reason that I want to tell you this is because I hope that you're excited enough that everybody's going to go back and get a FIB and start milling cells. And when you do, and you know, there's just a thousand little things that are very annoying and take some time. So just pick up the phone every time you have one of them and ask us, because it's very easy to get through them once you know the answer, as usual. I mean, this is true for any electron microscope. But so the first, which is probably something you just don't think about, is the working distance of focus ion beams and our dual beams. The specifications from companies are actually very wide. So we had a problem that at some point we had to change the stage, and then nothing fitted anymore. And they're like, well, we're within specs. And they were. And that was 3 millimeters away, and it was a disaster. Just something to think about when you're choosing systems and whatnot, something that you need to take into account, but it's really no drama. The next one, and I told you before, is the vitrification. So here we're at the limit of what we can do. What I showed you today was cells that can be grown on a grid or just deposited on a grid, like yeast. I grow them in solution, just put them in there right before plunging. As I mentioned, the plunging conditions matter. So too many cells will actually turn out in bad vitrification, even though in principle there should be okay. So it should be relatively sparse. You also have to have them sort of in the center of the grid. Which is what areas are accessible by both wherever you put it in the TEM and the focus ion beam. And so this is important in solution, of course, and an extension will be high pressure freezing. And there's a lot of labs, including ours and companies, that are working on solutions for going into tissue and these kinds of things. This is going to introduce another world of pain in how do you decide. I mean, if it's hard enough on a cell, and I'll talk a little bit about localization of the areas that you want to fib. Spacer grids or lift outs or anything that has been high pressure frozen means tons more material, and how do you find, you know, a little thing over there? So this is an area, but it's definitely work in progress, and it's going to be good. Transfers, as I mentioned, were a nightmare, but that's not anymore the case. Really, the autogrid completely solved all of these problems, and I would never go back. And again, you can put in a Polara cartridge. In the Weissman, they actually are milling out space in a side entry holder to just hold an auto grid, and that's how they're going to be doing their fibbing, hopefully in the near future. This curtaining that I showed you earlier, what that is that, well, what we think that is, but is that sometimes the focus ion beam comes and finds a region that's a little bit more dense than its surrounding. And so gallium starts getting deposited over there, so it doesn't mill away, it just deposits over there, and then the more gallium you have, the more gallium gets deposited. And what it ends up being is areas that are a little bit thicker than other areas. And this... So for me, it doesn't matter. I have a curtain. I go to another part of the nuclear envelope, and I take my tomogram anyway. But if this is the one place where you wanted to take data and it's significantly thicker than the others, well, then you're in trouble. We've now tried platinum coating. So focus ion beams come with, some of them anyway, come with a gas injection system. In our case, it's platinum. And you can basically just make a layer of platinum, and this is, again, done in material sciences routinely, on top of your cells. And then that it's kind of 1, 2, 3, and that's enough. And you aim for something like a couple of microns. And this actually made the curtaining go away, and it's beautiful. The one thing is that it required the GIS is actually where the focus ion beam is, more or less at the same angle. So if you want to deposit platinum, you actually have to do it like this. So you have to rotate the grid. And to do that, we needed a stage as the one that we designed, which basically has rotation in all degrees of freedom, which is not what comes out of the box. But again, it made so much better the milling. The lamellas sometimes tend to be thinner in the front because the beam is not perfectly focused anyway, not in the entire length of the cell. So you start getting defocus on the front and therefore erosion. So the front of the lamellas are definitely thicker than the back by, I don't know, a few tenths of nanometers. This is not the case either with platinum coating. So it's significantly and consistently nicer samples. All right, yeah, so this is curtaining. So this is a tomogram again, a lamella of yeast cells from before. So this one's broken. And you see here, there's actually, there used to be more cells here. There were never half cells that have been now sort of milled away. And you can see the tips. And I don't know if you can tell, this is a little bit darker here. And you see the curtains. And normally they initiate, you see, in a place that has probably a high density area in the cell, God knows what. And this is with platinum coating. So you see, you still have some streaks, but in general it's much smoother, and then the thickness over the whole lamella is better. This is my personal nemesis. This is a horrible thing. Goo. So goo sucks. We started having, or I mean, at least I started having a lot of problems where the lamellas look thicker than they should have been. And if you did an Eales measurement, they would tell you that they were like 450 nanometers. And then if you actually managed to reconstruct a tomogram, they were thin. And it was very difficult to figure out. I went and checked the other users. A lot of them thought they weren't having trouble, but they were. And we had leaks in the microscope. We had tons of leaks. So one source of leak can be, for example, the nitrogen hoses that come in to cool the stage. And if the nitrogen is not perfectly clean and you have a leak coming out of the hose, then you have a lot of water in the microscope. And these were like clearly time dependent. So a lamella that you did first was much worse than a lamella that you did at the end. We try to move it to just do the cleaning at the end and get the crap out of there, but that didn't work very well. And so this was just a matter of going, and it was just difficult to detect them. I mean, actually, the way that I figured it out was that one day I had a lot of contamination from the transfers in the TEM, and I left it for a few hours, and then you would see, because you can't see it in the reconstruction, it just looks gray, like the rest of vacuum. But if you have contamination on top, you can figure out, like, oh, wow, there's 200 nanometers of goo. I can't describe it anything better over there. And so then, therefore, the data is much worse. You can't align the tomograms properly, and it was, you know, I mean, all of you know what it is when you don't have a good vacuum. But so that's something to keep an eye on. The samples look grainier. It's difficult to describe. All right, Bob was going to ask me about this probably. So I'm just going to come out and say he always asks me if there's charging. If you think about it, the beam will be in the middle of the lamella. It has no contact with carbon whatsoever. So you would expect horrible charging. We don't see it, which is miraculous. It could be that there's a little bit of gallium deposition on top of the lamella, and then it just sort of takes it away. I'm not sure, but we haven't seen it. Rado tells me that this will be a problem. Probably with faceplates, it will be much more evident. But for now, if it's not broken, we don't fix it. We do have a lot of alignment problems. Wow, I've been whining for a very long time. We have a lot of alignment, not a lot, but some alignment problems. There's no gold if you're in the middle of the cell. So for some people who are lucky, they're looking, for example, they're supposedly in the lab now looking at synapses. You throw in gold, and because he wants to look at the interaction between two cells, he actually gets beautiful gold, perfect alignment and whatever. For the rest of us, we have to use correlation methods. And they mostly work, but they don't work all the time. I'm still not convinced that we should go into some extreme thing of dipping now the grid in some solution that has gold to get markers on it. I believe in computational methods, so I think we're going to be okay. But this is what we have. I mean, if you think about it, correlation methods, for example, if you had an entire vesicle or an entire nucleus or so forth, wherever you tilt, you still have features in all of the projections. But now we basically mill away most things, so projections will actually have very different features on them. So if you grab some of these projections, they'll absolutely have nothing. So using correlation methods can be very difficult. In my particular case, it's very difficult to get grazing views of nuclear pores because you don't have a very good signal from the membrane. So it's unlucky. So here's an example. This is a nucleus at 0 degrees. And this is what it looks like at minus 30 and 40. So you can see that there's really not a very easy way. Actually, this is okay, because as long as there's some features in some of them, and some of them are pretty bad. By the way, this is like a quadruple winner. This particular lamella had goo, crystallized, and curtaining. So there, that's really, really ugly. Okay, so the last thing, which is not really going wrong, is just a challenge, and actually kind of a cool challenge to go into, is that we now have to push correlative light and electron microscopy to 3D if we actually want to use it to locate samples. So as I told you, I just cut through a cell and I get a nucleus and I'm a happy trooper. But if you're looking at something more, not more interesting, but more difficult to locate, for example, a focal adhesion, if you will, or a centrosome and so forth, you can determine this angle of incidence to a certain level. Of course, you just see what the stage says, but of course, there's variations in the carbon and the grid. But assuming that you can determine it to a relatively good level, you still have to know at what Z, your object of interest is, because of course, as you move in the focus ion beam, you will either end up with this thing inside your lamella or not. So this is sort of like the final frontier for localizing things. Or you can just mill and mill and mill and hope that you get it. But I don't recommend that. Okay, so with that in mind, I don't want to end on a bad note. So I really want to tell you that I'm absolutely in love with this. And I think that you can do all sorts of quantitative biology, quantitative cell biology with this method. And we're very excited about it. I mean, so of course, you know, it has some tweaks. But a lot of them are general to EM or cryo-EM. And a lot of them are not that hard to overcome. So by all means, go back and get a fib. It's cool. And with that, I would like to thank first and foremost Wolfgang for just creating this amazing playground that it's Martin Street and let me play and do whatever I want. It's a lot of fun. He's been extremely supportive. And Jürgen is basically running the show. I mean, he makes everything happen. All the microscopes run because of him. We're losing him to Utrecht soon. He's going to be partially in Martin Street, but that's going to be an interesting adjustment, and we're very happy for him. Felix is a very talented physics grad student who's also doing an MD on the side, and he's a very good friend of Tim, who's the engineer in our workshop, and together they've designed a chip to check for temperature changes from focus ion beam milling and sort of designed a lot of things that are related. And Alex actually got kickstarted the project, set up the fib, and supervised some of the activities. We have an amazing workshop. These are people that I've worked with in my project and others, and there's actually now other users, like 4 or 5, and other people that I'm very grateful for getting me started in Martin's Read. And with that, I would like to thank you for your attention.